This episode on the Nicomachean Ethics is brought to you with a personal gift in honor of the recent wedding of Matthew Decker and Amanda Schloss. As Aristotle says, for someone who is going to be happy, there will be a need of friends of serious worth. This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Tommy John. Tommy John makes underwear that keeps everything in place, whichever way a man moves. For 20% off your first purchase, go to TommyJohn.com/PEL and use the promo code PEL. That's TommyJohn.com/PEL. Promo code PEL.
The Partially Examined Life live show election special at Brown University will be on October 27th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about Alexis de Tocqueville and the problem with democracy. For more information, see PartiallyExaminedLife.com. We'll post a live stream of the event to our Facebook page. Listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 147 is something like, what is self-control? And we're continuing our discussion from way back in episode 5 to now read more of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, this time books 6 and 7. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at PartiallyExaminedLife.com. This is Mark Lintzmeyer, incontinent about some things, but not incontinent in general.
And where are you?
In Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn, not a fool, but acting like a fool, in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, temperate yet intemperate, in Middleton, Wisconsin.
So, this is like one of the famous parts of this book. Well, first, we are all supposed to listen to the old episode to continue that discussion. And I had in mind criticisms we've got since then. And the feeling like, oh, we've gotten so much more responsible now and we talk more about the text. And it's true, there are not a lot of quotes thrown around in that old episode. But man, in that old episode, we actually all had stuff to get off our chest. We weren't all emptied out like we are now and just have to use the book as the primary springboard. There's a lot of good dialectical back and forth, and it seemed...
What do you mean, like
personal
stuff? We were
talking like we were important. It was our first thing about ethics, so we're trying to get out what virtue is and what our whole understanding of a mature way to approach philosophical ethics is. And so I brought in methodological conservatism and things that don't really have anything directly to do with Aristotle. And I liked it. I don't feel like apologizing for it at all.
Yeah, I listened to it for the first time while I was driving back from Gen Con. And actually, my son and Mark's son, who were in the car with me, listened to it, the whole thing as well. And I was struck by how clearly you guys were at the beginning of the podcast, in the sense that you were still thinking about the activity of doing a philosophy podcast, and the anti-academic aspect of it was very ripe in a way that it is still true, but not as foot forward as we have been. It was endearing. It was nice.
It sounds like you're referring to our disdain of the issues of translation, whereas now we've done so much Aristotle that, yeah, we sure as hell better talk about phronesis versus hexis versus...
Yeah, I felt like you seem to have embraced that in a way that you certainly were not interested in embracing then.
Yeah, repetition.
When did you embrace that? Like the last time we...
Well...
When it's a central thing of the text, particularly phronesis...
You just don't like the word incontinence.
Being able to call this episode Aristotle on incontinence, I think, is going to be great. Is that translated in some other way in some of the other?
Well, and Sachs doesn't translate it as incontinence. He translates it as dissipation.
Okay. So what's the point of this reading? Why are we talking about incontinence here?
Actually, let's just say what translations we're using, since Dylan just mentioned Sachs.
I read the Irwin for the first time. In its terms of its vocabulary, it's fairly conventional in that he uses a lot of the standard Latin words that you're used to hearing. One of the things I liked about it is that with his own words, he breaks up the text in a kind of outline in a very unobjectionable way, in that this section does this and this section says that with five or six words, which helps a lot.
So I'm using a translation I found online, F.H. Peters. It's from 1893. And I actually looked at every translation I could find out there. I honestly thought this was the most readable. I also looked a lot at the ancient Greek, and I wish I had had a lobe to do that, you know, with the English on the one side and Greek on the other because I just found like a big text file that had all the Greek, but my English version doesn't have the line numbers.
Don't you live in a place that has a college or two that you could like go to their bookstore? You live in Boston, man. I mean, what?
Yeah, I could have bought. I've forsworn buying any books because I'm moving and I had thousands of books.
You're a founding member of a philosophy podcast in which we read texts and you forsworn.
Yes, I'm going books. Electronic.
And oh, okay.
I have found electronic versions of many Loebs, but this is one that's missing. All Loebs are now available online, but there's a very few libraries that you can get to them through the digital versions. Like there's Harvard and then there's a bunch of English universities. And as an individual, you have to pay a subscription that's a few hundred dollars a year, which I'm not going to do.
Do you find reading electronically tolerable?
Yeah, and I'm searching for better ways to do that because the Kindle, I like to get PDFs and read them, and the Kindle can do that. It's not great, but actually it would be fine if I could actually get the annotated PDF out of Kindle and onto my computer because I like to take notes switching back and forth with the document on my computer, and I just can't do that with the Kindle.
I still find it very hard to not want to write in my book with a pen.
I just bought something called the Sony Paper System or something. Sorry, Mark, I know we're off base here, but it's a 13-inch e-reader just for PDFs, but it has a surface that you can write on. It's supposed to be the closest thing that you can get to writing on paper. It's almost like interacting with an actual book, but it's electronic.
Well, as much as I think stopping to talk about what translations we're using for 15 minutes is not in line with probably listener priorities, I do remember now listening to our old episode, I kind of missed when we used to have a casual introduction where we talk about something irrelevant to the reading at hand, about what else we're reading right now. Or so talking about how we're doing reading, I think is a fine way to get going. Earlier this year, I was almost getting like I couldn't read regular books at all, but then I realized I just needed reading glasses. And so now I've come to terms. I just never needed any corrective eyewear my entire life prior to this last year. And so I resisted it quite a long time of looking into anything. And now it's fine. And I have multiple pairs of them scattered all over the house. But I don't mind books then at this point, but I've never been one to write in the books. And so I would rather have a screen as long as I can like actually copy and paste from it to my notes, which a lot of the way some PDFs are made, like the version of the W.D. Ross translation, which is what I'm reading in paper form. But I also just found a version of that online. So that's what I'm going to post for people, which is a little different. I think the original translation is from, it's either 1925, because that's what the first edition of the front says, or Ross did his translator's preface in 1954. But then apparently the translation was updated. So sometime in the 70s or 80s here, some changes were made to correct it. And I think one of the things they did in this paper version is they added those things you were referring to, Dylan, those descriptions of what happens in each section. Because I see the online version, also the Ross, doesn't have any of that. And I was excited about the Ross this time just because W.D. Ross is one of the great ethicists, meaning he was somebody who I read a section of on intuitionist ethics in a class and went on to teach that in another class. So therefore, he's one of the great ones. But at least he's one of the ones I've heard of that I feel like made an original contribution. So whether or not that seeped into the translation, it's nice to have a touch point and feel like it's not a stranger that you're reading the translation of. And I found it plenty readable. For some reason, neither of these versions have like the line numbers right next to it. In my paper version, it has the line numbers at the top of the page, like in the corner. Oh, yeah. Just so you know, this is 1149A2. And the next page is 1149A24. But like, that's not actually helpful enough for us to say, okay, we're going to read A19 right now. Here it is. Like, we'd have to count down, or I'm not exactly even sure how they correspond to the line numbers in the margins of this book. But in any case, we can probably go by section because the sections are short enough.
Yes, I don't have the line numbers, so we're going to have to.
And the sections are all editorial, right? And the subsections, I mean, like I said, I have them in here. But those are all editorial. None of that's in the original Aristotle in any way.
Okay. So it's not right. It's not just the addition of the headings describing the sections. It's the division at all. But I think at least the division is going to be standard across all of the...
If you have divisions. I mean, Sachs's translation has it broken into chapters, each book into chapters, which is conventional according to the Burnett Greek text. But it doesn't have the subsections that the Irwin and sounds like yours has.
Oh, one other thing about reading these PDFs online. So I was earlier using my actual Model 1 Kindle that you still uses the e-ink. And we had some horror stories about it, how it would translate PDFs into it with crazy capitalization and every fourth paragraph being really big, or it's random images, like a whole page would be an image and then it would make some of it into text. Anyway, it's readable, but it's not good. And it's a whole like process of having to download it and run it through this program and convert it and be at my computer and sync it up.
Well, you can read PDFs and highlight PDFs on the Kindle without converting them.
Not my old Kindle. You can't.
Okay.
You can't do that. And it's a small screen. So even if you could, yes, you can put a whole PDF there and see a whole page at a time, but it's really small. It's too small. So I've been just using the iPad for a lot of stuff, putting things in Dropbox and then opening them in iBooks. And I like that. I like being able to just like stretch the text bigger. The one thing that bugs me about it is I like when I'm on an e-reader or something like this, like if I'm just reading something on a web page, a really long web page or a PDF that's a web page on the iPad, then I'll constantly scroll so that what I'm seeing is like right at the top of the screen, because it's just less distracting to me that way. To be actually looking in the middle of a page of text is somehow distracting, whereas to have nothing above it or have a little white piece of paper when I'm using an actual book and hold that so there's nothing below it. I kind of like that little aid. But if you're doing that with a PDF in iBooks, it doesn't let you scroll higher such that it would go onto the next page. Like the bottom of the page still has to be at the bottom of the screen. And so you could just make it bigger and bigger and bigger until... until you're only seeing one paragraph on the screen, and then you can pull it up a little more, but as soon as you let go, it'll snap back down. So it like becomes its own, like reading giant text for just this little bit. And so then, and then you have to shrink it back down to switch pages. So it becomes a whole little dance just to like get to the bottom of a page.
So Mark, is this a vice or is it just a bad habit? This obsession with...
Well, that's a great... It just makes it easier. I know it doesn't sound that way.
I use the iPad now, and I use a program called PDF Highlighter, which is very, very good. And I really like everything about it, except for the eye fatigue. That is really the big problem.
Yep, that's what was better about the e-ink thing.
And it is a huge problem for me.
Yeah, I just find I like holding a pencil. I still
Yeah, that's
got
why
it.
I got this Sony thing. I'm hoping to recreate the...
I haven't liked holding a pencil for like 30 years.
And they say all that physical interaction actually improves your comprehension, and it's a big deal.
Yeah, no, when I went to college in my first writing class, of course, it was anathema in high school to do anything but like crack open your book. They barely wanted you to do that. And my first writing teacher, Ron Dore, took the time not only to talk about writing, but talk about reading and active reading. And he, you know, would show us his own books and talked about ways of annotating while you're reading. The kinds of things he did, and also noting that, you know, you're just going to develop your own annotation process along the way. I just embrace that wholeheartedly. And in fact, to my great dismay, I found out last week that several boxes of my books were severely water damaged, just molded beyond being kept, including my copy from my undergraduate years of Nietzsche that had all my notes in there, and my copy of Aristotle's Politics.
Well, now we have some material to give away to lucky winners of our drawings.
Yes.
There's a box of moldy books. Enjoy.
Yes.
But it has Dylan's annotations.
Dylan's house wet itself on these books.
Oh,
close to greatness. I don't know. I recall being at your house and flipping through one of your books and just seeing your notes on the side, and really just how much profanity was in there. I was really just stunned how many times you were telling
F you Nietzsche,
telling the author to,
and all the dildo pictures, right?
Wow. When you were a bored high schooler, as if I was listening to a lecture. That's how I treat my books.
So speaking of annotations, which when
lack
I do
self-control,
I just basically underline everything on the page and then put stars next to the truly important stuff. So you can be incontinent with respect to annotation as well.
I do sometimes get books that other people have done that with. I don't do that to my own books. And sometimes it helps. Like I kind of know what the important sections are of this Dewey text or whatever I'm looking at in advance.
No, I feel like someone else is controlling me. Controlling what I should find interesting. I don't like it.
if you reread, do you read the book that had your annotations, or do you?
I do, and it's weird.
It's a little weird. I feel a little self-judgmental.
Like, what, yeah, this is the mind of someone 10 years ago who didn't understand this as well.
One of my colleagues at St. John's, he insisted on reading a fresh one every time and annotating it. So on his shelf, he would have, because, you know, you'll teach the same seminar several times in a row. And so he would have 3 or 4 or 5 copies of the same book, each with different annotations in them.
That's like one of those billionaires that like can only wear a pair of socks once. I have no sympathy.
But it feels so good the first time you wear those socks, Mark.
Look, if you're writing all over your socks, you'd have more sympathy.
I feel like that's a very minor vice. If you're a billionaire and your vice is that you have a brand new pair of socks every day, good on to you.
Yes, but that's usually the canary in the coal mine for other problems. So, to go from one.
Oh, I love it. The canary in the coal mine for truly intemperate vices.
Screwed up stuff. But I was actually, with that whole incontinent annotation thing, I was trying to segue us back to the...
Yes, I know. I was intemperately preventing you doing so.
Book 7 is the one on continence and incontinence and pleasure. Book 6 we threw in there kind of as an afterthought. It's about virtues of the intellect. And it kind of just lays out a lot of the difference between phronesis, practical wisdom, and wisdom proper, philosophic wisdom.
I don't think it does. And I think that's the problem with Aristotle, is that it looks like he's running through a bunch of terms and definitions and
he's thinking
subdivisions, but it is actually a very subtle argument.
Do you want to start with incontinence or do you want to start with book 6?
Let's start with book 6. He starts out talking about the mean, which is the standard of moderation. From previous parts of the Nicomachean Ethics, it's sort of the thing that we sort of aim for in virtue is somewhere in the middle between excess and deficiency. What does this have to do specifically with the intellectual virtues?
Well, at least in my translation, you're right. He starts that way, thinking about what is correct reason, getting into what the virtues of thought are. And he just recapitulates about the mean. And he says, to say that virtues target the mean is admittedly true, but is not at all clear. For in other pursuits directed by a science, it is equally true that we must labor and be idle neither too much nor too little, but the intermediate amount prescribed by correct reason. But knowing only this, we would be none the wiser about the medicines to be applied to the body if we were told we must apply the ones that medical science prescribes and in the way that medical scientist applies them.
Yeah, he wants to get more specific at that point.
Yes. We wouldn't know what to do.
The mean is what he says right reason prescribes. So when we're talking about the intellectual virtues and reason, we sort of go to the core of, I think, what we mean by the mean. But basically, what he ends up saying is that right reason is too vague.
Yes.
So what are we going to do about that? Well, let's analyze the intellectual virtues specifically, and then that's where he makes this subdivision between the moral virtues and then the intellectual virtues. And then he subdivides the intellectual virtues into the rational and the irrational. And then we get a subdivision of the rational into the scientific and the calculative or deliberative, where the former is sort of focused on the invariable first principles of things and the latter is focused on what is variable in the sense of particular things, the empirical or the kinds of things that you could be focused on if you're worried about action.
Practical reason.
It could be practical, but it doesn't have to be.
The beginning of this is similar. He does a similar thing at the beginning of chapter 7, where he basically says some kind of summary about where we're at. And in this case, that leads to saying, well, but we don't understand something very well. And so in order to really understand what we were talking about before, we need to understand this other thing in more detail.
Well, the other part of this is, you know, when we say right reason is a standard, it's not going to be some external thing for Aristotle. So when you try to define virtue, you have to look to the virtuous person. In other words, we have to pivot right back to specific virtues. We can't remain at the level of right reason or some external standard. We have to look at the functioning of the organism or the human being in this case to get at any standard at all. And he's going to actually reiterate this in various places in book 6 and book 7. So the way he ends this first section, at least in the way this first chapter of book 6, is to say, so, you know, we need to look at each of these faculties we need to look at the ergon of them, the work of each of these. It's
the work
of,
in the sense of the activity. That's a bad choice of words because it ends up being sort of technical in a lot of translations, but it's the work in the sense.
Well, it's often translated function as well. The ergon, the work is in sense, the sense of the function.
Yep.
So it's kind of a hint that the standard will come out of the function of these different faculties.
What it does when it's doing what it does.
Yeah. And when we say faculties, this is where we, you know, we ought to get into the Greek a little bit because we're translating. That's one translation of this word hexis, which comes from the word to have. So it's literally a having, but it can be translated as state, or it's often translated as disposition. And in fact, Aristotle in another work says it's actually a type of disposition, explicitly says that. So disposition is actually not a bad word. Faculty, I don't think, is a bad word either, because the kinds of things that will turn out to be hexae, or, you know, all these faculties we're looking at, you know, so for instance, nous, which is reason, when we think of reason as a faculty, and art and science and phronesis, prudence, all those things actually will be hexae. They'll be these types of states within the, I'm going to say mind, but within the soul.
So where does that show up in your text? I want to see what my translation has for that, hexis.
So you should see it pretty early on in 2.
So of these sensations originates no, the virtue of the thing is relative to its proper work. Now there are 3 things in the soul which control action and truth, sensation, reason, desire. Of these, sensation originates no action. This is plain from the fact that the lower...
Not yet, keep going.
Has it come up yet? Where is hexis in here? Okay. The lower animals have sensation but no share in action, so action is praxis there. What affirmation and negation are in thinking, pursuit and avoidance are in desire. So that since moral virtue
state.
Is a state of character concerned with desire...
Yeah, no, character, sometimes it's translated as character as well. Many translators will give you 2 translations in one go. So he could be just saying state or character as a translation of hexis.
Yeah.
Well, state of character is what it says in mind. So you're saying that whole thing is hexis.
One of the problems with state is that it, maybe even state of character, doesn't really bring out the notion of activity that's implied with hexis, which is often what the objection is with using the word state for it.
Yeah, it sounds too passive.
Yeah, too much being-oriented rather than becoming or process-oriented.
Hey, before we talk more about Aristotle, I want to thank Tommy John for supporting our podcast.
Yeah, they actually sent us some free underwear.
Yeah, underwear and undershirts and socks.
Right. Basically the most comfortable underwear I've ever worn. I've never been a consumer of high-end underwear, but now I think I may have been converted.
Yeah, I agree. The underwear was super soft, and the undershirt, I wear undershirts all the time at work, and I liked how light they were and cool, and they also stayed tucked the whole time. They come extra long, which for me, I have a long torso, so it's been hard to get t-shirts that, especially after you wash them, don't just start riding up.
Yes, it's a much different experience than, let's say, your average Hanes.
Yes.
Or Fruit of the Loom t-shirt. Very high Older. Quality. Feels nice.
Yes. Tommy John is revolutionizing men's underwear with products that focus on fit, fabric, and function. The shirts stay tucked, the socks stay up, and underwear keeps everything in its place. They also have a wide selection of styles. Their underwear comes in briefs, square cuts, trunks, boxer briefs, and boxer shorts. Their undershirts come in a variety of necklines, and their socks come in all colors and pattern options to suit all tastes. Tommy John provides a best pair guarantee. If their underwear isn't the best you've ever worn, it's on Tommy John.
And as a special offer to our listeners, get 20% off your first order by going to tommyjohn.com/PEL and using the promo code PEL. Plus, get free U.S. shipping on any order over $50. That's tommyjohn.com/PEL, promo code PEL. If you love to read but don't have time to read as much as you want, Audible is the perfect solution. At audible.com, you can get audiobooks and listen to those books you've been meaning to read while on the go. So at the gym, during a commute, while taking a walk. And audible.com has audiobooks from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. The app is free and works on iPhones, iPad, Android, and Windows Phone, and you can download and listen on your Kindle Fire and over 500 MP3 players. And unlike a streaming or rental service with Audible, you own your books, so you can access your books anytime and anywhere right from your smartphone. Audible.com also has the Great Listen Guarantee. If you decide you don't like the book you choose, no worries. You can exchange any book you aren't happy with for another title anytime, no questions asked. Audible.com is offering a free 30-day trial membership. Go to audible.com/PEL today to start your free trial. That's audible.com/PEL.
For those suffering with an addiction problem who have unsuccessfully attended treatment, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone and that treatment should address the multiple needs of an individual and not just the drug use. Recovery should move beyond coping with addiction to helping people thrive. Gulf Breeze Recovery's Thrive program is a holistic non-12-step treatment system that not only treats the true underlying cause of the addiction, but also addresses the individual's physical, spiritual, and mental needs. Gulf Breeze Recovery helps people discover a fresh new outlook on life that enables them to be captains of their own ship. The waterfront facility is neat, clean, comfortable, offers private and semi-private rooms, a lighted fishing pier, and a large swimming pool overlooking the water. You can view the webcam, take a virtual tour, and get more information at gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-9-HOLISTIC-REHAB.
All right, thanks. Back to it.
Just a little bit earlier, he has the two parts of the soul, one with reason and one's non-rational, and then divide the part that is reason that he calls the scientific part and the rational calculating part. In my translation, since deliberating is the same as rational calculating and no one deliberates about what cannot be otherwise. I found that division interesting because in some sense what he's calling the scientific part ends up being basically reason about things that cannot be otherwise. And the calculating part, rational calculating part, is reasoning about things that could be otherwise, which ends up being directly related to everything from practical reason to ethics.
So for instance, we could demonstrate the Pythagorean theorem, and that is one of these sort of necessary truths.
Scientific truths, yep. In his way of speaking.
And what is scientific? What is that a translation of?
So it can also be knowledge sometimes.
Yep.
So it's okay, people, don't freak out because he's calling science this thing, which is really about metaphysics or something else. It's just that's...
And it's anything that's demonstrative, which is apodeixis, apodeictikon, I think. So those two go together. So science is this realm of really strict demonstration and necessary truths. And it's a very limited domain for Aristotle, because lots of things, of course, are going to fall outside of it. If you're not dealing with these invariable necessary truths and principles, you've stepped outside of the domain of science. And then the calculative deliberative, there's two words, and this will kind of come up. One of them is logistikon, that's the calculative, and often logos will also be translated as calculation in this, but logos can also be translated as reason in the sense of, abstractly the reasoning. But reason as a faculty is nous, or mind, and then the activity of reasoning is dianoia. Finally, and sorry, Mark, I know, just to get this out of the way. The deliberative faculty, deliberations, is bouleutikon, or kos, bouleutikos, I think. So that's more like a planning type of activity.
Well, this is all going to be kind of relevant in that, just one of the last episodes we were talking about how reason doesn't, in fact, give you directives by itself. And throughout some Kant or perhaps on some interpretations, not all Twitter users agreed, but Sam Harris and Ayn Rand, throughout all these examples of people that think that reason just tells you what to do. I don't think that's actually accurate for those, but it doesn't matter. Aristotle, however, we're directly addressing that question in this section, is in virtue of what? Aristotle's kind of known as the father of reason in that he thinks you can use reasoning to figure out the existence of God. And just the way he's talking about science and reason, or at least a certain philosophic reason, apprehending necessary truths, makes it sound like a lot of the hard work of philosophy, including maybe fundamental ethical principles, is going to be determined just by reason. But we're going to see here that that's not quite the case. The fact that he's going to distinguish these four different states of character or something like that is going to tell us that there's more to the story.
Yeah, and it'll turn out that action requires desire, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So action is thinking infused with desire. And desire is also an activity of a rational activity.
Right. That's actually right where I had stopped reading at the beginning of 2, because it's a therefore. So he's not just making those claims. He's saying, therefore, what affirmation and negation are in thinking, pursuit and avoidance are in desire. So that since moral virtue is a state of character concerned with choice, and choice is deliberate desire, therefore both the reasoning must be true and the desire right if the choice is to be good. And the latter must pursue just what the former asserts. There's a lot of latter and former in this text that you have to look back.
That's very true in Aristotle. When you read him in the Greek, you have to constantly keep track of that.
So the desire must be right, so I'm not desiring things that are in fact harmful to me. And the reasoning must be true. Now, does that mean the reasoning means ends analysis must be true?
Yes.
Or just the recognition of what you should be shooting for must be accurate in the first place?
It's the means end analysis. The word there that he's using is logos. The word, by the way, for choice is prohairesis, and it's also a hexis. It's another faculty. The faculty of choice.
So that does sound funny that to say just in English, choice is deliberate to desire. Like, well, really? Can I just choose something whimsically based on no desire at all? But no, authentic choice, what it is when you're actually doing it in your day-to-day life is, according to this picture, desire, but that you think about. You're not just an animal that is pursuing what it desires. You're affirming it rationally.
Yeah, we should say that action here, or praxis, is a very, like, animals can't act for Aristotle. So they can do things, but they can't act in this strict sense. Action is something that comes out of reasoning.
I think it's also important. We often use words like reason in a way that says that we always mean good reason or something like that. When we say something is reasonable, we mean that, well, it's properly deliberative and stuff like that. But I think you have to be careful when Aristotle is breaking these things into parts. It's not always the case that there aren't shades of degree, even in the broken down subcategories. In fact, there almost always is ways in which things in one version or another overlap with each other. And just because it's reasonable doesn't mean that you use your power of reason well. So in a case of choice being whimsical, it still doesn't make it desire absent reason. It just means that in the example that Mark gave to me, I think Aristotle would just say, well, you just didn't do a particular deliberative job of it. That's just the diagnosis of the character of choice, because there isn't the same kind of choice making going on in animals, which is the big difference for Aristotle.
So practical reasoning is looking for this agreement between truth and right desire. So unlike these other, a more theoretical faculty, which is just looking for truth, the practical reasoning is always looking for this intersection between truth and right desire. And later on, he'll say, you need nous, you need the faculty of reasoning and the activity of reasoning that goes along with it. But you also cannot do without a sort of ethical state of mind, which is closely associated with having the right desire. You can have all the reason that you want, but without the right desire, you don't get anywhere.
In fact, it's in part, this will lay the foundations for just the possibility of the discussion in Book 7. You know, the possibility of incontinence relies on the fact that you can know what you ought to do, but not do it. That's the whole kit and caboodle of incontinence. And that possibility means that you can be thinking about it and be right thinking about it, but unable to, or you don't have the desire aligned with it so that you commit to the activity.
And why would this be an issue? Because Plato said that we always pursue that which we think to be good.
Yes, in knowledge.
And it seems like the person who eats the extra 3 pieces of cake, knowing that it's unhealthy to do so, I say this having my birthday having just passed and having faced exactly this issue and failed.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. It's hard to understand that on Plato's picture. You know, we have this idea that even villains, they don't pursue evil because it's evil and then cackle. Like, they think they're doing the right thing.
In Book 7, we'll get the distinction that Aristotle makes, that the part of that he agrees with Plato, but this part that he flatly disagrees with Plato is that you eating those 3 pieces of cake, Plato would say, is you just don't properly understand the good. You don't understand your own good. And because you don't understand it, that's why you fail to act.
This section was setting that up, And it's setting it up by giving us the general framework to talk about what produces an action, which strangely enough, and this is very much in keeping with Aristotle's reputation as kind of the father of reason, is a syllogism. Like if you know that it is bad to eat lots of fatty things, bad for your health. And then, so that's the major premise, this universal claim about health and fatty things. And then the minor premise would be this piece of cake in particular is pretty fatty.
Fatty things are not to be eaten. This piece of cake is fatty.
This piece of cake is not to be eaten.
Yes.
Yes. And actually the conclusion is not even just recognition of the proposition. It's not a matter of knowledge. It's actually supposed to produce the action of not eating the cake. That's what a practical syllogism is, and it produces an action.
But there are ways in which our knowledge of the universal premise fails. We can say the universal premise and think we mean it. So that's why someone could go through that syllogism and still eat the cake.
And the important point there is that Aristotle would say, you fully know that, and yet you still fail to act. Whereas on the basic Platonic understanding is you'd say, your failure to act means you don't really know, because knowing would imbue your activity. So he links knowing directly with activity.
All right. So then let's back up to book six here. And what failure, let's keep reading to see, figure out what failure it is, which faculty of intellect is missing in the incontinent person, or what are the options here?
Before we move on from section two, I just wanted to reiterate this idea that you can't do anything without desire. So reason doesn't set anything in motion. And what we need are goals or ends, or actually he uses this Greek phrase, hei henika or hou henika, which is often translated as final cause or that for the sake of which. And we're going to find out later on that we can't reason our way to those ends either. I mean, except in the sense that we can intuit them with the faculty of nous, of reason, but we can't discursively, through demonstration, through calculation, we can't arrive at ends that way. So we have to get them in some other way.
We can't be drawn to anything by reason.
Well, so those are two different propositions. One is, can I know what the good is just by reason alone? And then the way Dylan was put it, can I be drawn to the good just by reason alone? And it seems like somebody like Kant would be completely comfortable with saying, yes, you can know it, but...
So this is why we can know the good. We can know the good through reason in the sense of the faculty nous, but that's an intuition. That's intuitive. That's like, it's analogous to perception, except it's reason. It's sort of like the Platonic contemplation of a form. But you can't calculate. You can't, in the more typical sense of reasoning, the non-intuitive calculation sense, you can start with principles and then derive ends. You're never going to get it in that sense. And that's why, so he'll later on, he'll say nous is what we use nous to intuit the ends of things. So the telos. So the telos of an organism, when you discover that, you do it in a sense empirically, but you're doing it with nous. So that's all I'm trying to point to. It kind of becomes a big deal, I think, later on.
All right. So are we still on two or are we on?
And then the end section two, just by, because it's such a nice phrase, choice is a reason that desires or a desire that reasons. And it constitutes us as human beings, this sort of combination between desire and reason. So again, it's a very interesting picture of this sort of intersection between desire and reason.
So your translation, this is 1139b5.
Yep. It's at the very end of the section two.
So it's my section 6.13. So my section two is associated with where he begins talking about scientific knowledge. But I think this is the line. My translation calls it decision, not choice. Hence, decision is either understanding combined with desire or desire combined with thought. And what originates movement in this way is a human being.
The actual Greek, again, choice or decision is proairesis, and sometimes it's translated as purpose as well. Proairesis is an orektikos nous, is a desiring reason, or anorexis dianoi etike, or a desiring reasoning. Dianetike is a reasoning. So the translation that I gave is actually very accurate. I think the combination, this idea that just combining them doesn't get at the kind of radicalness of what he's saying. He's using them as adjectives to each other. So it's a desiring reason or a reasoning desire.
Yes. But the end of that is also important, in which he says that that is what makes a human being. It's the source of being a human being.
Yeah.
Desire fused with reason in both directions.
Yeah.
So my translation is more accurate, but nastier. Hence, choice is either desiderative reason or ratiocinative desire.
Holy crap.
Yes, 1920 something, right?
Just for, you know, get a third one. Saxes says, for this reason, choice is either intellect fused with desire or desire fused with thinking. And such a source is a human being.
Yeah, I don't know why they want to do the fusion thing.
Such a source.
It makes it less radical.
I agree. It'd be interesting to talk to them about it because they're clearly, as translators, making that choice where they think just using the adjectives back and forth is, I don't know what they think. I agree with you. I think that it is both more radical and more evocative of what's being said.
Yep.
For this alone is lacking, even to God, to make undone things that have once been done. Why is that part of this section? Oh, so he's quoting Agathon. Sorry, I'm just reading something out of context. It is to be noted that nothing that is past is an object of choice. That is part of what he's trying to get at. No one chooses to have sacked Troy. And Agathon is right in saying, for this alone is lacking even to God to make undone the things that have once been done. It's just trying to illustrate what deliberation is, that you're always deliberating about something that is
right,
that you're going to do, right, not about the past. That's not what deliberating means. You don't deliberate about the past. And if you don't agree with that, you're just not translating the Greek right.
So in this next section, we get the different ways of arriving at truth. Art, science, prudence, wisdom, and reason.
In my translation, it breaks them into craft, scientific knowledge, intelligence, wisdom, and understanding.
Yeah. So the Greek words are techne, episteme, yes, which you could say science. I think yours had a...
scientific knowledge.
Scientific knowledge. Phronesis, which is prudence. Sophia, wisdom. Nous, reason. So those are the five.
Yeah. In mine, it's intelligence.
Phronesis is practical wisdom for me, not prudence. Yeah.
So that's the biggest
difference. Oh, man, because my translation translates something else as intelligence.
Really? Okay. Wow. Yeah, that everything is intelligence. Exactly. These are all types of intelligence.
So we try to be attentive to that, but in mine, he translates phronesis as intelligence. And what's the one after phronesis in your translation?
Philosophic wisdom for me.
Yeah, wisdom. And what's the last one? That's for understanding.
Noose.
And mine is understanding.
Oh, see, mine is intuitive reason.
Yes, which is completely misleading because it is intuitive. Noose is intuitive reason. So.
And understanding is something else for me later.
Yes, understanding is gnome.
All right, so we're going to go through some of this slow enough so that people can just learn it by the Greek words. Episteme and noose and phronesis, those at least we can get.
Well, I think the most important thing is understanding the distinctions of kinds of thought, these virtues of thought that he's making, what he's distinguishing between them. And we can use the Greek words as the shorthand if we want to. That's fine.
Well, with the difference in, translations, I think it's helpful. But
yes.
Yeah. So we get a section here on how science is focused on these invariable necessary truths. But he makes this interesting claim to the effect that universal principles, in a sense, they don't fall within the province of science because we can't demonstrate them.
Yeah. So you can't do metaphysics with episteme.
Yeah. So we need induction to get to those universal principles.
A good example, and if we ever do Aristotle's metaphysics, I think it'll be even more clear, is we couldn't come up with the principles of logic using episteme.
Yeah. Or I think for geometry, if we wanted to say the axioms of our geometrical system, so the point is that which has no part, those are sort of intuited or things that come from induction. Yeah. So these are these starting points. Yeah.
So in Euclid's geometry, there are these things that are stipulated at the beginning, and then based upon those, you demonstrate a whole bunch of different theorems, which is the way everybody does geometry, right? And mathematical proofs is you have the class of things that you say are stipulated, and then you make your derivations dependent upon them. But those first things aren't part of scientific knowledge, according to Aristotle.
So in contrast to this domain of the invariable, these necessary truths, we get the domain of the variable, which can be techne, it can be art producing things, or it can be action. Which he makes a big deal of saying that is a completely different thing than art because it doesn't bring anything into being.
So production contrasted with action.
So production, the word for that is poesis, which is sort of what you do when you're doing techne, when you're doing art, you produce things. And again, these are both faculty. He's using this word hexis constantly. So the faculty of acting from calculation, calculation is logos, is different from the faculty of producing from calculation. So that's really the kind of the way he spells that out. But they're both calculative. They're both in this realm of the variable, the empirical realm. You know, you're dealing with things that change. And so unlike these necessary truths, like a point is that which has no part, we're dealing with the cat is on the mat, to bring up a popular contemporary analytic example, contingent things, and then we make calculations with regard to them.
So again, techne as art is referring to things like architecture. It's not necessarily referring to like the fine arts or anything like that. It's just anything that is sort of a principled way of making things. And we can remember Plato talking about, you know, is rhetoric an art or is it just a knack? Like, does it actually have rules or is it just something that people are good at? Is it systematic? So art is still somehow systematic, but it is practical. It deals with the particular ultimately.
All right. Let me get phronesis, which it's practical wisdom for you, Mark. I think that's better.
Regarding practical wisdom, we shall get at the truth by considering who are the persons we credit with it. Now, it is thought to be the mark of a man of practical wisdom to be able to deliberate well about what is good and expedient for himself, not in some particular respect, for instance, about what sorts of things conduce to health or strength, but about what sorts of things conduce to the good life in general.
He ends up giving a very specific definition of prudence or practical wisdom. And again, he makes this point of saying it's not a science because it's the sphere of action is in this world of the alterable. But he calls it a faculty of acting according to correct reasoning, or maybe a better way to say it is a faculty of reasoning correctly in a practical way. When we use this word practical, we mean something that issues in action as opposed to theoretical, where it just issues in knowledge of truth. And specifically about human good and evil. The faculty of acting according to correct reasoning about human good and evil.
Which that business of correct reasoning, towards the end of the section, he says that it cannot be misused. Practical wisdom must be a state grasping the truth involving reason and concerned with actions about human goods.
That's the same as
Moreover, there is virtue of craft, but not of practical wisdom. In craft, someone who makes errors voluntarily is more choiceworthy, but with intelligence, as with the virtues, the reverse is true. Clearly, practical wisdom is a virtue, not craft knowledge.
Craft and art being the same thing. Yep.
Yes.
So in art, what you're doing is a means to an end that's outside of that doing. And in action, the action is its own end. This is a point he's going to make elsewhere. I think he repeats this later on as well. So phronesis does not, like poesis, have its excellence or its virtue or its completion. That's another way of thinking about excellence and virtue. It's complete development in something other than itself. So with art or making, you complete something, you make it. And that's its virtue. And that's the virtue of the thing is whatever you've made and its completeness and its and maybe other things about it. But in action, in phronesis, the virtue of it is the action itself.
Yeah. So mine says it's not that the action is its own end, but for an action, good action itself is its end. So every action is trying to be, just like Plato said, everybody tries to aim at the good. Well, that's kind of actually in the nature of action itself. That's what action is that it aims at being good action. And it's just, well, what does that mean? This is the next question.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure that action by itself is always aimed at the good. Phronesis is action aimed at the truth.
I thought phronesis, it's not that it's aimed at the truth. That's part of it, but that it does it effectively. Practical reason is about, so if I think that already I'm aimed at a correct end for me nutritionally, say, and I understand basic physiology, then the phronesis is what allows me to connect my actions with that. Is through experience, knowing about particular foods and whether they're good for you or not, and how to eat.
Yeah, the way he uses the word true here is true reasoning, or sometimes translated as correct reasoning, although some translators go out of the way to make it clear that phronesis is an apprehension of a kind of truth. But I think from the Greek, it's true reasoning about human good and evil, and that's of a practical sort for the sake of action.
We credit men with practical reason in some particular respect when they have calculated well with a view to some good end, which is one of those that are not the object of any art. It's calculated well, that's the means end analysis thing, and it has a good end. Those are the two elements for phronesis.
Yeah. And then good action, again, the end is the action itself, because I think that's a radical thing and that's worth emphasizing. So when we talk about an action being for the sake of the good, I think it can be misleading.
Sure, sure. A good action is for the sake of itself.
Yeah. Or if we think about it as being for the sake of happiness, because a good action is a manifestation of happiness. It is, or flourishing, eudaimonia.
Right. So we're going to talk more about happiness next time. I don't want to give away the fact, but yes, this is going to be another two-discussion episode, a four-parter for you non-citizens. But yes, we did discuss in the earlier episode 5 quite a bit what this whole difference between happiness as a feeling, the way we might think of the English word, and happiness as eudaimonia, the word that he uses, and how those are different. So we shouldn't spend time on that now.
Yeah, as long as we keep in mind this. It's kind of radical idea that the action itself is the end. It's not for the sake of something else.
Yes, and in some sense, the whole book is directed about happiness as the proper end of human life.
Which, almost knowing what I do about teleology, sounds like it's true by definition. Because when you say anything has a telos, has an end, its end is what is good for it. Like, so saying happiness, eudaimonia, is the telos of human life. Well, isn't that almost just saying, okay, everything has a good built into it, and we're just going to give the name eudaimonia to what we understand the human good to be. It is virtue, it is happiness, it is all that stuff.
Well, so the more impact version would be living the flourishing life is living virtuously, which has more baggage and is not quite as much
sure.
a truism.
Yeah, so well-being. I like the word well-being.
Yep.
Well-being is, you know, instead of happiness, well-being is when our faculties are functioning at their most actualized level. When you're engaged in a good action, you're functioning. That is what well-being is. So it's not like I'm saying to myself, yeah, I'm going to do this good thing because I'm going to feel good afterwards. The good thing is the manifestation of well-being.
And this is why habit becomes so important, because virtuous actions are ones that you aren't trying to make yourself do. It's the ones that you're just doing because that's what you do.
Nicely put.
Well, and I think summing up what the book is about is a great way to end part one of our discussion. So come back next week for part two of the discussion, or become a partially examined life citizen. Hear the whole thing in one go, just as God intended, just as the telos of the discussion intended. Later.
For those who have attended addiction treatment without success, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone. Gulf Breeze Recovery is a non-12-step holistic treatment facility that is successful in helping people break free from the addictive lifestyle. Visit gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-6-HOLISTIC-REHAB.